So some of the questions we've been sitting with, I've been sitting with for us to hold this weekend are, how do our lives hold the story of Easter? And how do the stories of Easter hold our lives? How do we move beyond being spectators at the audience of retelling an ancient story so that we're just watching it? And how, when I talk about this story, do I avoid getting stuck in theory? Because if we observe this story from the outside, then it's tremendously historically interesting, but it doesn't actually have a daily impact on how we live and what we do. But if this is the story of events that reveal to us who God is and how God works, then this is the place that our whole lives come out of. And obviously much of Christian tradition has upheld Good Friday as the absolute definition of our faith. And for me, it is a story that reveals God. But it does that within the context of the wider story of Jesus' life and of the Jewish and Roman cultures that he lived within. And that wider context includes resurrection. Resurrection's not a good news, happy ending footnote tacked on to the main story. Life, death, and life is the very nature of God who we have revealed to us at Easter. So how does this Easter story motivate us to live in a particular way? Now, there's a few possibilities, and if any of these are what motivates you, let nothing else I say undercut that, but I want to just draw a picture. It may be that the horrors of Jesus' passion deeply move us to self-reflection, and that if we believe that Jesus endured this torture for us and for our salvation, then we must somehow respond. It is possible that we can respond to that with irritation. We never asked you to do this for us. We don't need your dead, tortured body, thank you very much. Now, we are less likely to have come to Easter camp to rehear the story if that's our reaction. But I think we do need to recognise that it's not an irrational response to somebody believing that they need to be tortured for us to respond with irritation and say, thank you, we don't think you actually need to do that. Probably for those of us who are here, it's more likely that we respond to this offer of an innocent life with some sense of indebtedness. And I think actually that probably underpins some of the reactions of irritation, because we feel indebted and we didn't ask to be indebted and now we are. Indebtedness may come out of a place of feelings of guilt and shame, that somehow you or I would be so rotten that this sort of torture is necessary for us somehow. Or our sense of indebtedness could come out of a place of gratitude. As the words of that song, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross," were the whole realm of nature mine, it were an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands myself, my soul, my life, my all. And either guilt or gratitude can motivate us to live the way that God desires for us. Now, I suspect that's roughly what underpins most Christian devotion and Christian efforts to serve others. The sense that Jesus reached down and saved me when I couldn't save myself. Therefore, I will reach down and save others, lift them up when they're in need. Another slightly different way we may respond to the horrors of this passion story is that witnessing Jesus' suffering makes us somehow want to alleviate his suffering, to help him to suffer less. In the Stations of the Cross tradition, to be the one who wipes his brow or who carries his cross for him. In the Matthew 25 tradition, whatever you did for the least of these, the motivation then is, because I want to make Jesus' walk to the cross less painful, I will try and make someone else's walk to the cross less painful, because in doing that, I'm serving Jesus. And they are all things that lead us to making the world a better place. So I don't want to undercut that. But today I want to particularly look at, and this whole weekend really, look at another possibility for how the Easter story can motivate us. And in this I'm significantly influenced by the book called Compassion, which is by Henri Nouwen and Donald McNeil and Douglas Morrison, even though Henri Nouwen seems to be the only one who gets his name on it. The way of Jesus is self-giving love. And so the death of Jesus is the culmination of a life of self-giving love. And in this, Jesus shows us that God's way is not to conquer, to win, to defeat, not to be in triumph, but that God's way is to descend, to fail, to lose, to die. Now that is completely counterintuitive to our whole culture and everything in us about how we live. And that counterintuitive way is what leads us into resurrection. Resurrection is not God leaping back out of the grave to say, ha-ha, I actually can conquer. I actually am the big winner. Resurrection is out of this transformed way of being when we've lost everything, God creates something new. So from this perspective, I think Easter can motivate us to live in ways that reflect the way God chooses to work. That is, because of who God is and because of who we are as children of God, we are called into the self-emptying way of being. The self-emptying being in the world, which I would say the word is compassion, which literally means to suffer with. Now, in general use, compassion means to act kindly towards someone or even just to feel kindly towards someone. But that's not the meaning of compassion that we get from Jesus' life and certainly not from Jesus' death. Compassion for Jesus is not an emotion, it's a way to live. So compassion's talked about in pretty much all world religions, and it's often within a framework. Cynthia Bourgeois, no, can't pronounce it, Bourgeois. I even went on Google pronounce and had it talk it to me, and I still can't get it. Bourgeault. Cynthia. She writes in this area, and she calls it ascent mysticism. And this is the idea that we are born with a certain amount of spiritual energy that we then nurture and discipline and develop so that we become a better influence on ourselves and on the world. We become more godlike, more loving. In Eastern traditions, the word for that is enlightenment, but I think in our Western tradition, that underpins some of the teaching around things like sanctification. So in ascent mysticism, compassion is a discipline that gradually transforms us, largely by developing our empathy. And as we are transformed, we get more loving and we do less damage and we enable more good. There's a bunch of books from the library that I've put out. Some of them are from my personal collection, but some of them are from the library that I got in preparing for this weekend, one of which is from Karen Armstrong. It's a book called 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. And she is within this framework. She's attempting to integrate Eastern and Western traditions of compassion. And she's really a good illustration if you want to get your head around how compassion works in the ascent mysticism kind of framework. And the thing that's so powerful, and Cynthia Bourgeault, she acknowledges it's powerful because it works. Self-disciplined attention to being more compassionate does actually make us nicer people and better people to be in the world. But Jesus shows us a different way. Jesus does not seem very interested in being a better person. And he doesn't seem very interested in enlightenment or getting closer to God. He seems quite secure in himself as the beloved of God where he is. What he seems most interested in is being with people who are on the margins, or in fact who have fallen right off the margins and been run over. Robert Farah Capon, who's one of my favourite authors, repeats the phrase, the last, the lost, the least, the littlest and the dead, as the people of where God is and who God seeks to be with. The last, the lost, the least, the littlest, and the dead. Jesus comes to suffer with us, not to reach down and lift people up to his level, not to help them self-discipline themselves up to his level, but to suffer with. To relentlessly refuse to fight violence with violence, never to respond to oppression with power, especially not to respond with a power that those he's suffering with don't have access to. He doesn't come in with some divine, in-reaching zapping of others that the poor he is with can't do. And living this way challenged the whole structure of his society, and it challenges the structure of ours. Societies are built on hierarchies of power. And those at the top never have to notice that those on the bottom have to be on the bottom for you to be on the top. And empires are built on violence. And religious institutions that find peace within empire have made peace with violence. In Jesus' context, the Jewish religious establishment had found a way to coexist with the Roman colonizing power. And Jesus came in, and his way of being reminded the people of Israel's prophetic role to be the people of God, the beloved people where no one was in need. And that was not what the religious establishment was doing, and it revealed what was going on. Jesus just suffering with his people revealed the embeddedness of religion and empire, and they killed him for it. So in this Easter story, Jesus reveals who God is and how God works. And God is a God who suffers with us, who doesn't use force to establish a reign of love. God is a God who will be where we are, even if where we are is publicly questioning the existence of God, which is where we see Jesus on the cross when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? G.K. Chesterton suggests that in that cry, Jesus seems for an instant to be an atheist. He is so profoundly at one with human suffering and with human experience of feeling cut off and abandoned from God that he's able to express that sense of God not being there. Lingering into theory again, and I really don't want this to be a theoretical thing. So pause and be aware. Where is your pain? Where is your struggle? Allow yourself to trust that God who loves you is in that place with you, experiencing what you experience. That may be all you need today, and you can stop listening to me. Jesus' self-emptying was not just that he left behind his divine powers and became fully human, but he spent his humanity being with those who suffered. Leonardo Boff, the liberation theologian out of Latin America, says, since God hung on a cross, God is particularly in solidarity with all those who hang on crosses, those who are humiliated and crushed. We know this because Jesus shows this God to us in his life and in his death. And Jesus says to us, be compassionate as your heavenly Father is compassionate. He also says, be holy as your heavenly Father is holy. As Matthew Fox Riley observes, he does not say, be contemplative as your heavenly Father is contemplative. So how then shall we live? The compassionate life that this Jesus calls to us is a life of suffering with. This is holiness. This is being set apart for God, is to suffer with. Complete inversion of the values of our world, which always tell us to get ahead. Henri Nouwen calls it downward mobility. And Matthew Fox contrasts it with our culture of constantly climbing up ladders. Matthew Fox calls it phallicism. He says, phallicism, the worship of upness. And he calls it America's dominant religion. He wrote over 40 years ago, and I think he would still be very accurate there and here. And much of our religion, our religious tradition, subtly approves and supports this attention to upness. Actually, not so subtly. If you any Christian bookshop or most Christian libraries, skim the titles and you will find plenty to encourage upness. Mother Teresa very famously said, "We are called not to be successful, but to be faithful." Now, sometimes we can hear that with a sense that success is a bonus. If we're very faithful, we might get some success. But I think the way of the cross actually calls us to be unsuccessful. Compassion is in direct contrast to competition. And our culture is built on competition. We instinctively judge people in terms of how they rank against us. Are we kinder? Are they smarter? Are they more beautiful? Am I more healthy? Whatever it is, we find a way to adjust to a pegging. And much of our effort goes into a subtle manipulation of our place in whatever hierarchy we've decided we were going to work with, to work our way up the ladder. As I read this book on compassion from Henri Nguyen, it was the most jarring experience. I was in a coffee shop reading this stuff, and the women at the next table, I wrote it down because I was just so stunned, said, "You've got to be manipulative. You've got to save your own skin." I couldn't have had a more jarring experience of the two worlds happening at once. I was literally reading Henri Nguyen saying, "We need to put you down with mobility," while the women said that in my ear. No, I did not. When compassion is taken to mean to act kindly towards someone or to feel kindly, it doesn't challenge us to move down. You can be kind within the culture of upness. And kindness is often charity. It's often giving out of my excess, giving from my position of relative power to benefit someone who's less fortunate. It's a reaching down. Possibly a reaching down to lift someone up to my level. It's very Henry Higgins, if you know My Fair Lady. You know, raising the poor gutter snipe to respectable society. And like Henry Higgins, that often requires a great deal of work on the part of the poor gutter snipe and has lots of strings attached and primarily serves to make the giver feel good about themselves. The Nguyen McNeil Morrison book on compassion says, "Compassion is not bending toward the underprivileged from a place of privilege, but building a home with the underprivileged." Matthew Fox suggests three ways we can check whether we are being compassionate or whether we're doling out charity. The first is, am I being depleted to benefit another? Because in compassion, what I need and what another needs become one. Because if I am suffering with someone, then any relief they feel, I feel. It doesn't take life from me to lift them, but our being together in a place of pain may see us both lifted, or it may not, but we won't be alone there anymore. The second internal check is, am I prepared to celebrate with this person? If I'm handing out solutions to someone else's problems, then their celebration is not my concern. But if I enter into someone's suffering, then I also enter into the place from which they celebrate. Their pain is my pain, their joy is my joy. And thirdly, do I expect the person I am helping to be grateful? Somewhere a long time ago, I read a quote that said, "Who are you to expect the poor to be grateful to you?" And I cannot find who said that. I don't expect my sister to be grateful that I love her. I just love her. If I expect gratitude, it indicates that I don't feel we're equals. We have to be very careful not to now set true compassion as another goal we can achieve in our upness. Because charity is not bad. Kindness in response to Jesus' life is not a bad thing. But we need to know what we're doing. And we need to know where we can grow toward greater compassion and where we are in all our good intentions, reflecting the culture of upness that Jesus came to undermine. Our upwardly mobile culture, which is wedded to structures of power and violence, can and very well may crush us, even to death. But it cannot defeat God. G.K. Chesterton says, "The cross cannot be defeated because it is defeat." The way of the cross is not an accident from which God will recover. The way of the cross is the way. It is the way that leads to resurrection. We also need to be careful not to romanticize suffering. Matthew Fox talks about the church having a sentimental preoccupation with suffering. He talks about the church having a fetish with the cross. We are so focused on only, if we focus only on the pain, without being moved to relieve the pain of real people, then we're embedded in this fetish of the cross. God doesn't desire us or Jesus or anyone else to suffer. But God also doesn't rescue us from the inevitable suffering that comes with being alive, and particularly that comes with being alive in a culture of competition, drivenness, striving to win. God did not rescue Jesus from the suffering that came from his life of loving people, but God did raise Jesus to a new life. Resurrection is the action of love to create us as new beings of love, when we have nothing of the old upness left in us. When we have nowhere else left to go, the holding mystery of God's love abides with us. And in fact, I think having nowhere else to go may in fact be the holding mystery of God's love. The somewhere that we think we might have to go, that we could turn to, generally turns out not to be a source of life, but a temporary means of survival. Eventually, and maybe not in this life that we know, eventually, the abiding love beyond our nowhere else to go is the source of new life. So that's my thoughts for this morning. Does anyone have anything you'd like to say in response to that at that point, or sit with it? Well, let's sit with it over the weekend. Tomorrow, Maria Stewart is coming to be with us for a while, who is one of the icons of my life, of people who have lived lives in this way of self-giving love. So she'll share with us a bit of her life. On Sunday, I'll give a much shorter talk with some of the stuff out of what I've been reading about practical on the grounds, how might you actually get on with this? And then we'll have some more written discussion time on Sunday for more extended. So that's the shape of the weekend in terms of these morning content-y bits. So I'll leave you with that Jesus is the way of self-emptying, the opposite of upness, the downward mobility, and that's what Good Friday calls us into.